Welcome to the Institute for Government. I hope you've all got copies of our fantastic new report, which is published. I say, looking at the editor, Akash, who's on the front row, I think we're giving it away free to everyone who's come today. That's correct, isn't it? So you have, you know, the free copies. We'll be selling it, because they're in limited edition, for a large sum after this. But I hope you enjoy reading it. I would particularly draw your attention to the poll at the end, which is pages 78 and following, which shows, in headline terms, that Disraeli was right. England does not love coalitions. It didn't like the idea of a hung parliament without a single party majority before last May, and the proportion who are against has actually risen in the last year. 63% in our poll are opposed to believe it's a bad thing for the country not to have a single party majority, against 30% who are in favour. And if you look at the subsequent questions on whether people think the government is more or less decisive, more or less coherent, and so on all of these, there are very big majorities that believe it's weaker, less decisive, less coherent. However, being essentially pragmatic, what the British public also think was that the Liberal Democrats were right to go into a coalition last May. So being pragmatists, given the situation that arose, they thought it was right to form the coalition, but they, on the basis of what the those results show, the experience of coalition in the last year hasn't appreciably, let alone fundamentally, changed public attitudes, which remain hostile and very classical in their view of how British government should work, which of course was reflected in the AV referendum. So the poll is well worth looking at. The individual essays in the collection look at individual areas of the machinery of government and the wider political context in respect to the coalition. We hope you'll find those useful. However, I have a star-studded cast to discuss our report and the wider state of the coalition this afternoon. Jim Wallace is here in two respects. He is, though he has the wonderful title, as Advocate General for Scotland.
Indeed, that's right.
Which those of us who aren't Scots don't quite know what that means. We know it's something legal. But the equally importantly, he is steering the whole of the major constitutional reform programme through the House of Lords, which is a Herculean task because the House of Lords takes a minute interest in every aspect. And also he was Deputy First Minister and leader of the Liberal Democrats in Scotland in the first Scottish government, which of course was a coalition government between Labour and the Liberal Democrats. So he has a coalition perspective on this, which I hope he'll bring to bear. Nick Bowles is a political fellow here, as well as his many other accomplishments. Indeed, that's his most important accomplishment. He may also be a Conservative MP and a PPS to the Minister of State at the Department for Education. But he does sterling work with us here and helps to guide our research programme and has made a contribution to this book. Peter Riddle is a senior fellow here, has also just published a book, which I'm surprised he hasn't put on all of your chairs, which is A Defence of Politicians in Spite of Themselves, which is an excellent read, and some of you were here 2 days ago when David Miliband came to launch that book. And Will Straw is on loan to us from another think tank, the Institute for Public Policy Research, where he does a lot of work on the political and constitutional agendas, and of course founded Left Foot Forward, which I think now is largely self-organising and doesn't require his day-to-day and minute-by-minute attention, so he's able to be with us this afternoon. Nick is going to start, then Jim, then Will, and then Peter. Nick.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you, everyone, for coming along to celebrate with me the first year of what I trust will be a fabulous five-year coalition government. I very briefly do want to make the argument to you that if the coalition did nothing more than complete the current bits of legislation in Parliament, and you might have noted that that itself is proving a little more testing, but nevertheless, that if it just completed the welfare reform bill, the education bill and the academies reform, the police commissioners bill, the localism bill, and the fiscal consolidation and the mayoral referenda that is in the localism bill. If it just did that, it would have a very fair claim to being one of the most radical governments of the post-war period. And that, I think, would surprise everybody, all of us in this room, if you'd said that to us a year ago when it was being formed. I think we all entered into that process with the expectation that it would be weak, that it would be divided, that it would actually not be able to do much more other than perhaps, hopefully, getting a grip of the fiscal crisis. And it has been much more successful than I think that any of us had expected than I had expected. Having said that, I think that the way I characterise it in my little comment in the book is that the last year was blitzkrieg, lots of tanks moving very, very fast over the terrain, enemy disorganised and not really able to do much to stop us, every now and then driving off a cliff, but doesn't matter, there are plenty more tanks, so carry on. I think this is the end of blitzkrieg. I think that the next 4 years are going to be a long, hard slog. And in that extent, I think that that's not very different than most governments. I think that the IFG actually did some research at some point before the election into what policies that people think in hindsight are the defining reforms of a government. When did they start? And I think that they found, and that this was common to both the Blair government and the Thatcher major governments, that they almost all of them started in the first year of the government. They may have taken longer to complete, but they started in that first year. So I don't think it is necessarily a peculiar problem that this government will face, that actually your biggest, most radical measures start in that first year. Of course, we all know legislation is only but the plan. The implementation of the plan is what follows, and that is what I hope and trust this government will be focusing on. Just a final point. I think that you've all, as some of you as observers, have all been rather hoping that we would all return to Westminster and immediately start tearing each other's throats out after the somewhat intemperate campaign on both sides over AV. The one thing that I have been struck by in the last week in Parliament, and I accept that Parliament is not where everything happens in politics, and activists, party members and voters, their views matter a lot too. But in terms of the working of a government, what relationships in Parliament are important. And it is extraordinarily clear that the relationships that have been formed between Conservatives and Liberal Democrats, not sentimental relationships, fundamentally working relationships, but they have returned very, very quickly to being very, very productive and workmanlike. Now, of course, there's going to be more noise and there's going to be more argument. But the fundamental relationship that underpins this, which is that our country's in a mess, we came together to sort it out, we're now tied to each other, our survival as individual parties and as individual MPs depends on working together. Nothing has changed about that, and that is why I suspect that four more times we will be meeting here to review the performance of this coalition. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your first of four contributions over the next... Jim.
Well, thank you very much. And can I say, I too, like Nick, I'm celebrating this first year of coalition government. And I do think the the first chapter which Akash has written, I think, is actually very perceptive in many of the conclusions and many of the observations which he's made. And he does say, in fact, that this has actually been an effective government in terms of the government has actually worked. It has been a strong government, and I think it's given the lie to the view that coalitions are inevitably weak. The list of measures which Nick has just referred to does indicate that the government has not been afraid to actually come forward with some very bold measures, quite apart from, of course, what is out there at the absolute core is the joint commitment on both parties to tackle the fiscal deficit, to put the country's finances back on a sound footing. And that, of course, is crucial because I think this is it's a coalition of necessity. It was one which last year, if you go back 52 weeks, I certainly was very strongly of the view that if Liberal Democrats had walked away from that situation, it would have been, we might have had problems on the doorsteps in the last few weeks. I think we'd have had even more problems on the doorsteps if people had turned around and say, you guys can't be trusted to take responsibility. And it would have been a very difficult thing to say. When you had an opportunity to take responsibility, you ducked it and you ran away. I think there's a number of reasons why that has been relatively effective in that sense. The personality one, which we've just heard about, I can confirm that my ministerial working relationships tend to be mostly with the Attorney General and Solicitor General, and also with Mark Harper in relation to the Constitutional Reform Programme. And Monday night of this week is the first time I've had a meeting with the Attorney General, which he's offered me a drink, whether he thought I needed it or not. It's a very important point. This is not I think if you remember the Rose Garden and everything, it was all seemed to be lovey-dovey. Of course, it's not. It's not a marriage. It's not even cohabitation. It's a joint venture with business partners. And as I say, and it's got at its core an objective of restoring the country's economic situation. Now, I think the other point I make is similar to what I found in Scotland. I find that when you're in committees, ministerial meetings, more often than not, the contributions made by ministers of different parties reflect what the issue is and what they think, how that issue should be taken forward, reflection on policy options that have been put forward, rather than, you know, a tribal approach. And I think that is healthy for the most part, but I think too there is a danger in that in terms of a coalition, particularly maybe the junior partner in a coalition. I mean, most of you here, I suspect, have read Gerald Kaufman's book, How to Be a Good Minister, and you'll be aware or familiar with what he describes as departmentalitis. And if departmentalitis is a problem in a single-party government, I think it's much more than a problem in a coalition government, because our junior ministers very much have got to be not only part of their department and make a contribution to the department, but they've actually got to be the eyes and ears for the Liberal Democrats within that department, not just within their own portfolio. And I think that is important. I think it's important, too, in turn, that in departments where there is no Liberal Democrat Secretary of State, that the Secretary of State, the Conservative one, does recognise that the Liberal Democrat junior minister in that department has a responsibility to the coalition, indeed to the Liberal Democrats signing the coalition. It goes beyond just perhaps the specific subject areas to which he or she has had allocated responsibility. Another important aspect, too, of trying to make of the mechanics of the coalition is special advisers. And my experience in Scotland was very much just how important the role of the special adviser is. Special advisers are important for relationships with the other side, the relationships they built up with the special advisers, in our case with the Labour special advisers, because they were able to inform each other what the susceptibilities and what, you know, of each party was, what were no-go areas, how far could you take a particular policy, what would work, what wouldn't work. And that was very useful in oiling the wheels of government and dealing with officials, because they knew from both parties what people would wear and what they wouldn't wear. Vitally important for communication with ministers of both parties in the coalition, communication with our backbenchers, and communication with the wider party. And particularly when you're taking legislation through in a coalition, in a single party government, you'll always find some backbenchers that are not happy with this part of it or that part of it. And it's important that that can be flagged up, that the backbenchers have got, if not immediate access to the minister, at least, you know, they know how to get the ear of the minister. And perhaps it's one of the things which is not maybe as widely known or appreciated. I've seen it from the House of Lords perspective, but very often there are meetings with ministers from the Commons and my peer colleagues of both parties on particular pieces of legislation to try and work out, you know, if this won't work, what will work, what amendments will be acceptable, what amendments won't be acceptable. And a lot of time and effort is required, but it's time and effort, you know, that has to be put in if a coalition is going to work. And perhaps the final area of reflection is the importance of party identity. I mean, when I took the Scottish Liberal Democrats into coalition with Labour in 1999, I was acutely aware that the issue of identity for the junior partner, you know, was an absolutely important one. How do you actually maintain your identity? And I think Akash, in his chapter, does talk. I can't put my finger on it immediately, but the public doesn't necessarily like or doesn't warm to the arguments of what would have happened if we hadn't gone in. They can't see the parallel universe. Actually, we were quite fortunate in Scotland because we did have a parallel universe, because there was a Labour government continuing without Liberal Democrat influence in the rest of the United Kingdom. And we were able to show the things that we had done as Liberal Democrats that made a difference, why Scotland was different with a Labour government or a Labour-Liberal Democrat coalition as opposed to a continuing Labour government in London. And that raises that its tensions. I mean, many of my Labour colleagues in 1999 assumed that because we'd entered into a coalition, we had given blank check to anything the Blair government was doing at Westminster, and it came as a rude awakening when we told them they weren't. And clearly when there was an invasion of Iraq, which was not in any way a devolved matter, we took very distinctive positions. But it was important too that we took these distinctive positions, argued them very strongly, but the relationships within the coalition were still such that on a day-to-day basis we were able to govern Scotland on the range of devolved. And therefore I think what I learned from that is firstly that it's important that you badge issues. We had to badge issues as Liberal Democrats. And I think increasingly it's important that we badge some of the things we've already done, but make it more clear that that was a Liberal Democrat influence. And as we go forward, there will be certain issues we will want to identify, changes we will want to make, and it's important we badge them as Liberal Democrat issues. and that you actually can have distinctions and differences. But if you're actually grown-up people with a grown-up objective, then you actually can manage these distinctions. And both parties are going to have to give each other slack in this, because I'm sure the Conservative Party is as interested in maintaining its identity as we as Liberal Democrats are in maintaining ours. That maybe there's got to be more daylight in on what is the mechanisms of government, that it's not just a decision that emerges at the end, which we all are responsible with collective responsibility, but that the way the process of getting there and what the party interests in getting there was, that that perhaps sees more light of day than would normally be the case in a single party government. And the final reflection is, if we're doing that, can the Fourth Estate also live with coalition government? So that every time there's a difference, it's not, you don't seem to have a banner headline that, you know, yet another split and the government's about to fall apart. I think we've got to be grown up too to recognise that sometimes that these are very often exaggerations. I was once told in Scotland that a particular Labour minister was briefing against me. I said, so what? He spends the rest of his time briefing against his other colleagues. and you just shrug it off. But people, you know, and I think as the poll shows, people don't necessarily warm to coalitions. They like parties working together, but don't particularly seem to like the way the consequences of that, say, of that happening. And I think we've got to do more to explain what coalition government is about. No party won the last election. Therefore, no party can expect to get its manifesto through 100%. That's got to be explained. It's not necessarily a betrayal. It means that compromise is essential. British people tend not to think in politics that compromise is a good thing. And therefore, I think when we're looking forward and identifying differences between the parties, I think it's also important we try to do an education exercise that coalition government is, in fact, different. And it's no less worthy because, in fact, at the end of the day, it's seeking to achieve an objective common to the two parties.
Thank you. I could do one question to what you've said. If you compare the position of the coalition now with the position of the coalition which you were deputy leader of from 1999, 1 year in, how would you compare and contrast the positions?
It was difficult. I mean, when we came sixth in the Barnsley by-election, you know, and oh hell, it's awful. I remember we came sixth behind the Hamilton Accies Supporters Club Hamilton by-election when we were about 6 months in. And therefore, we got a lot of flack. But over time, perception changed. There was delivery. And I think, and this is, you know, not something one would wish for at all, but we were undoubtedly, the fact that I became acting First Minister when Donald Dewar took ill and subsequently after he died, in many ways that helped bind the coalition. And indeed gave, you know, showed that it was actually a coalition of the two parties. Now, no one wants to go down for a repeat of that, but it, you know, it's a factor you can't ignore. It happened, therefore I think at this stage, at 1 year, it was still pretty tough. But what I do remember, Donald Dewar being interviewed on the first anniversary and said, what are the achievements? And he listed three things that he'd resisted but the Liberal Democrats had insisted on. So it's,
Will.
Well, to coin a phrase, I agree with Nick and Jim. I think this has been a very radical government that's been working well for the most part up until now. When you look at the economy or public services, penal reform, civil liberties, these have all been areas where a lot of action has been taken in a short space of time. Where I depart from their analysis is whether that can continue. It seemed to me that the respect which Nick Bowles wrote about in his essay in this book broke down during the AV election, as did the balance that's so important to the coalition. So when you go back to a year ago, there was balance. The Lib Dems had ministers roughly in proportion to their seats in Parliament, in fact slightly more. As they're fond of reminding people, you now will have to start again.
So. We'll read into the record.
Yeah. So, and as they're fond of telling us at the moment, 75% of Lib Dem policies were in the coalition agreement, just 60% of Tory policies. So there was that balance, and the four priorities in the front of the Lib Dem manifesto were in the coalition agreement. So that balance, I think, was in place at the start. But I think that's broken down. I think that the two reasons for that are, first of all, Cameron's been emboldened by the AV election. He took that bold action and it worked for him. And he's now strengthened his position inside the Conservative Party. And also, I think, as the leader of the country, as the Prime Minister. But Clegg has been very much diminished by the combination of the AV results and the local election results. And it'll get worse. This time he was going from a 26% base in 2000. 2007 down 17%. In 2008 and 2009, the Lib Dems were on 25%. So it's very hard to see how they do anything other than having similar losses in future years. And then when you think about what their strategy is to respond to this, I think two things we've heard about. One is the differentiation strategy, and the other is the sort of intricacies that Jim was talking about of how things work inside government. But the interesting thing about the poll that's been done for this book is that on differentiation, they're actually already there. I was very struck by the showing that only 28% of people believe there is no difference between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives in terms of their views on the most important policy questions. And actually, as well as Andrew said, on the right, they were right to join the coalition where there's a majority, there's actually only a small minority of minus six on whether the Liberal Democrats have had a significant influence on government policy as a result of forming a coalition with the government. So I think the public accepts the fact that they were right to go into coalition. They can see a difference, and they think over the broad sweep of policy, they're actually have been doing something. The problem is on the policies that matter to them. So when you look at the more specific areas, on NHS reform, it's minus 27% think they're making a significant impact. On tuition fees and university funding, minus 37%. And on tax and spending decisions, minus 17%. Those are the issues that voters care about. And on those issues, they don't think the Lib Dems are having any impact. I think that's very difficult for them unless they replace Nick Clegg or have a U-turn on those, you know, really, really important issues. And I think that's really the bind that they're in. Clegg describes the coalition agreement as his original sin. And I think it's turning out that is very much the case. And it's hard to know how they turn that around. In terms of, I'll talk very briefly about the Labour Party as well, because one of the questions we were asked to look at was how the opposition has adapted to the challenges of opposing the coalition. I think there's an interesting debate in the book about whether the job of an opposition is to oppose the government of the day or to act as an alternative government. I think in terms of opposition, there have been some decent progress in framing the way Nick Clegg has seen in terms of the general public, much less success in framing the way that David Cameron's seen, or indeed George Osborne, who, you know, just over a year ago was seen as the weak link and is now a much, much, I think, stronger politician than he was before. They have sort of put pressure on the government to perform some U-turns on things like building schools for the future, school sports, and potentially now on police numbers where pressure is ratcheting up. But some of the bigger, more high-profile U-turns, like on forestry and on the NHS, have either been because of civil society pressure, interest groups, or the internal dynamics of the coalition. So there have been some areas where Labour has been a bit sluggish in getting its attacks in. Even so, on the economy, although there's been a reluctance to set out their own set of spending, what their own spending cuts would be. I think Ed Balls has been effective in making the story much more about growth now, and that's put pressure on them. They haven't tried, I don't think, at this stage to be an alternative government. I think the gamble is very much that this coalition will last the distance, or very nearly last the distance, and therefore it can take its time to put a proper policy position in place. That has an immense amount of sense, as far as I'm concerned, but there probably needs to be a greater sense of what the strategy is and what the kind of key themes and key areas they're focusing on are. I'll leave it there.
Thanks very much, Will. Peter.
Thank you very much indeed. I just want to make a couple of points. Apart from being stirred by Nick's metaphor about the Blitzkrieg, remember it all ended in Stalingrad. But that was a few years in, so that happens. So I was struck by that. I just want to make two points. One is a kind of, because the coalition's so new, we tend to view everything through the coalition. And everything has happened over the 12 months, it's something to do with the coalition, which isn't all necessarily to do with the coalition. And indeed, a lot of the tensions within the government are actually sometimes between inside a single party, rather than necessarily Lib Dem versus Tory. A lot of the arguments are much more complicated than that. I mean, classically on Home Affairs between the Home Office and the Justice Department, which have to be mediated by Nick Clegg as Chairman of the Home Affairs Committee. Or, as we saw earlier this week, Vince Cable in disagreement with Chris Huhne on climate change policy. So it's more complicated than that. I mean, just to give an example, which hasn't really been fully touched on, is on Parliament, where Akash's chapter on that makes the point the most significant changes in Parliament haven't actually been to do with the coalition, but to do with some reforms which were launched in the last Parliament, mainly associated with the Right Committee, which were accepted in principle in the last Parliament, were taken forward by George Young and David Heath, an interesting con-lib double act as Leader of the House and Deputy Leader of the House, particularly the direct election of the chairs of select committees and the election of all their other members. Now, that is noticeably having an impact. Now, that would have happened regardless of the coalition's existence. And there's a danger, of seeing everything in the light of the coalition. And equally, if you look at what's happened in Number 10, which Joe Rutter has done a chapter on, a lot of the changes there are to do with what David Cameron's style and approach as Prime Minister, his initial hands-off style, and then the realisation perhaps the centre might like to know a little more about what's happening in departments, and the creation now of the Policy and Implementation Unit, the Analysis and Research Unit, which is an internal change, which might well have happened anyway with a single-party government. So I just want to make that point first, because I think it's quite an important one in relation to looking at the coalition. The second one, which is a related one, is, and I think this is in a sense the verdict of last Thursday's elections, is that I don't think either the political world or the public, it's not just a matter of not liking coalitions, but not really adjusting to them. My sense, and it's quite a strong one from the AV campaign and certainly the propaganda in the AV campaign, and also from looking at Whitehall and Westminster, is that last year's election result is still regarded as an aberration. It's regarded as a temporary breach in the normal pattern of single-party government, which we've had with rare exceptions since 1945. Of course, if you look back, actually, to when Disraeli made his famous comment in 1852, he was actually defending a pretty odd budget he was trying to defend at the time against the probability, and what happened, being defeated by a coalition which was facing him. But since then, for a third of the time, we have not had single-party governments. But, of course, for the last 65 years, apart from February 74 and the tail end of a couple of governments, we have had single-party government, and that has conditioned everyone's attitude. And I still think the majority of the political, and certainly my former journalistic colleagues, and a fair slice of the electorate, are still in a majoritarian frame of mind. And I think that's is possibly the most significant thing of all when one looks at the coalition. Therefore, I mean, the Lib Dems, made a lot of mistakes before the election. They were very well prepared for negotiating for government, not so well prepared for government. I think in fairly short hindsight, they would certainly not have signed the NUS pledge on tuition fees if they'd remotely thought they were actually going to be in government and have to implement it, because it was a completely daft thing. No one would have thought that you could possibly sustain that in government. And that is an adjustment they've had to make. But I think it's a broader adjustment for everyone's regarding that changes in policy, which are inevitable in the coalition. I mean, I think the most fatuous argument I've ever heard is I didn't vote for that. Well, actually, no one voted for a coalition because we didn't have a majority government. But you have to adjust to that. You have to accept compromise. Now, that is natural in systems which have coalitions fairly normally. As in Germany and in much of the rest of Europe, people take positions and accept there will be compromises on it. Indeed, I mean, Jim was there in Scotland for the first two of the elections when that was the result. And everyone expected before both the first and second elections there will be some kind of coalition of the type that has happened. Now, one of the ironies, of course, the electoral system, which was designed to produce not to produce a majority government, has now produced one. A wonderful illustration of the law and unintended consequences. We got not quite the same in Wales, but almost that. Just as the electoral rules for the election of London mayor were designed to stop Ken Livingstone becoming mayor, something else happened. But I think exactly in that way that the electorate nor the political classes have adjusted to the compromises, the changes which are required for coalition, because they don't believe it's going to last. And we see this, and it's illustrated in a couple of the chapters, inside government itself, where government is still operating by the conventions of single-party government. There's a real resistance to some of the points Jim made of, well, we've got to adapt. Where there's a Lib Dem undersecretary in a department with five ministers, with a Conservative Secretary of State, well, actually, that Lib Dem minister isn't just a junior minister with a small portfolio. He's the Lib Dem representative in that department. It obviously varies depending on personality or what you do in the five departments where there isn't a Lib Dem. I don't think the system's fully adjusted to that. It's also reflected in Nick Clegg's own office, which has been a painful struggle to build up and recognise that as DPM, he's got to cover the whole waterfront of policy. I think the system is taking a lot to adjust to that. And I think now, when we get to the point of separate stressing identities, a more muscular relationship, never quite understand what a transactional relationship is. I think most of us spend all our time doing transactional relationships. But if it is going to be slightly more separate, that challenges many of the conventions of collective responsibility. About how open a debate is held before decisions are taken. So to sum up, I think that we are in a kind of limbo of attitude and approach we see what the next election produces. Only if we have two or more elections producing hung parliaments will, I think, the system move from the partial adaptation we've seen so far to a much greater adaptation. Now, of course, the sophologists say we're now more likely to get hung parliaments, even despite the change in the formula for constituency boundaries, which obviously alters the arithmetic a little bit. We're more likely to have it because in recent general elections, less than 70% of the electorate have voted for Tory and Labour. Now, that could change, of course, next time. But until we have that procedure where we don't have regard this as a temporary situation, I don't think the system will fully adjust. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks. Both Nick and Jim predicted that the coalition would last for 5 years. Peter and Will, what's your prediction?
At least four.
At least four. Will, are you underbid or overbid?
I mean, I think it's probably is heading for five. I just wonder about the what happens with the psychology as the election approaches. I think there's sort of first mover advantage inside the Liberal Democrats for somebody who starts to sort of set out an alternative to what they would do in the event of another hung parliament. I think that makes it for a very, very interesting dynamic. So I could see the whole thing sort of falling apart maybe after the 2014 elections at some point after that point.
So we have three, four and five all on offer. Who'd like to kick off with the first question? I'll take
Wicks, and then I'll respond. I see Michael Wicks.
As an opposition, MP, I understand why Jim and Nick award the coalition very high marks, and reminds me of the dangers of self-assessment. can I ask two questions? I mean, the historian would have to check whether this is really true, but there's the contrast made between the Blair government, which supposedly for a year or two didn't move quick enough, and this government in 1 year with Nick's blitzkrieg, a comparison that many of my constituents would understand. Now, what strikes me as an opposition MP is that despite the strength of this government, with the first whiff of grapeshot on certain issues, forests, school sport, notably the National Health Service, the government seemed to buckle. The Prime Minister has a tendency to ditch his colleagues. Now, why is that? It certainly is not something you'd have seen during Mrs. Thatcher's period. So what's the panel's comment on that? The second one is, how do we understand the Conservative Party now? Because not so long ago in opposition, it was all cuddly centre-ground stuff, yes? We're going to save not only the National Health Service, but the planet. We hug huskies, all that. A serious attempt and a successful attempt by Cameron and the Conservatives to move to the centre-ground, not least on the National Health Service. Now, with whatever one, whether it's justified or not, huge public spending cuts, yes? Bringing forward the big society to try to keep their libraries and their forests. It seems, in terms of impact, like a pretty right-wing Thatcherite government. So where is the Conservative Party in all of this? What kind of party is it? Is it One Nation or is it Thatcherite?
Thank you very much. Nick, major becoming a Labour MP's hegemony, but Nick Rainsford is next. And then I see Lord Norton sitting behind him. Perhaps he would like to redress the balance afterwards.
Yes, sorry to follow Malcolm. I actually want to pick up the blitzkrieg image and raise two questions about it. Blitzkrieg is fine when you're going forward, and this last year, you know, has, as Nick said, been a year of rapid advance. But actually, after that, you have to consolidate and you have to run the countries that you have conquered. A lot of us who have looked at some of the legislation that the government is trying to get through Parliament with various degrees of of difficulty, basically take a view that it bears little or no relationship to the practical processes of putting those policies into effect. A lot of it is declaratory, and the link between that and, should we say, effective implementability, to use a terrible word, is not at all clear. The second question is a rather more direct one. There are inevitably casualties, and what happens, because Akash in his paper rightly highlights the difficulty of reshuffles in coalition, what happens when Panzer commanders Lansley and Pickles and Cable and various others, unfortunately their tanks go over the cliff, as Nick said?
Parallels becoming a bit strained, but we'll... Lord Norton.
Right, well, here's the question I didn't plan to ask. Peter touched upon the position in Parliament, the changes that have been made, and really what I want to touch upon is to expand it slightly in terms of the relationship between the two chambers once you've got a coalition in place, because you've got the configuration within each chamber, but then you've got the relationships between the two chambers, and to some extent what's left out is the configuration now in the Lords, because in a way it's created more problems in the Lords in many respects than it has in the Commons. But of course that...
I wonder whether I could ask you, Philip, just to say a few words yourself about how you see relations between the two coalition parties in the House of Lords.
Well, it's fairly... I think it's much smoother in the Lords than it is in the Commons because of the nature of the Lords and the personal relationships that exist. So if you like, I think there's less tribalism. Where it causes a problem, of course, is because of the pre-configuration that when you form a coalition, it very much changes the nature of the House compared to what it was previously, because no government at post-1999, the Labour government didn't have a majority. And we're now in an unusual situation where you've got two coalition partners who together are much larger than the opposition party. So a great deal depends on the crossbenchers. So there is some conflict in the House in, if you like, the opposition takes the view that the government has built majority, but that's very much in relation to them. The government takes the view, well, you're leaving out the crossbenchers, and they do now make the difference. And I think to some extent, Labour is looking at interpreting in terms of what happened in the last Parliament, where the Liberal Democrats were the swing votes. So whichever way the Liberals went, then that's likely to determine the outcome. And not really taking into account what's happened in this Parliament, where the crossbenchers are now much more likely to turn out in some numbers on particular issues, and they do make a difference. So if they're there in numbers and they divide disproportionately against the government loses. And so the government's now lost 16 votes in this Parliament. Now, virtually all of those have been the result of how the crossbenchers have divided. One or two, you've had a split of about 80 crossbenchers to three against government. We might now have seen a change this week. There's been two defeats in the Lords in the past couple of days, fixed-term Parliament's bill and the next day on the Police and Social Responsibility Bill. Now, they're different. Because how the crossbenchers voted was necessary but not sufficient for the defeat. The government lost the fixed-term Parliament bill vote because some Conservatives voted against and that made the difference. And yesterday they lost because 13 Liberal Democrats voted against and that made the difference. So we might be seeing some change now because of what's happening within the parties rather than simply how the crossbenchers have divided. But we are in a new situation. And it is causing some conflict, because Labour, say, think the government's got this inbuilt majority, and the government keeps thinking we keep losing.
Thank you. Well, there were four key questions there. Is this a government of U-turns? If I can use a slightly different German analogy, are we looking at a Thatcherite or a kind of Adenauer Christian Democrat-type Conservative Party? Is it a government which is producing policies which are unimplementable, which was Nick Rainsford's question as someone who's had to implement many tough reforms in his time, and Lord Norton's question about how the panel see relations between the two chambers evolving. Don't feel you need to answer all four, but Jim, would you like to make a stab at a few?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to, because I'm bound by collective responsibility, to speculate on why the so-called U-turns took place, other than to say, from what I can see, I think they could as easily have taken place under a single party government under, than a coalition. I don't think, I mean, a coalition obviously added to the dynamic, but I don't think it was exclusively a coalition, a product of coalition. With regard to Nick Rainsford's question, I mean, I think these are matters, no doubt, for the legislation going through as to, these will be well debated as to how practical they are. I don't think we've yet got to the stage where we brought forward legislation, you know, which says that the government deficit will be reduced by, what was it, by half in 4 years or whatever sort of targets were set, which were basically unimplementable. But I think Philip Morton's raises an interesting issue, and I think the first part is relationship between the two houses. I was in the opposition benches in the Lords for, what, 2.5 years? And was only really getting to get the hang of it when I went onto the government benches. I don't think the coalition has obviously made a difference for the reasons which Philip identified in terms of the role now of the crossbenches as opposed to perhaps the Liberal Democrats were the case, and that has made a difference. But in terms of the relationships between the two houses, I get the impression, and if you want to look at a speech that Michael Forsyth, Lord Forsyth, made in the Parliamentary Voting Systems Bill, when he said that when he was Secretary of State for Scotland, I think Lord Lindsay was the Scottish Office Minister in the Lords, and Lord Lindsay used to come to him and say, I need a bit slack in this, I need to be able to make a compromise here or give this. And Michael said, I used to say, well, that's just the Lords, go and sort it out. And I think the biggest difference, be it coalition government or single party government, is the House of Commons doesn't get the House of Lords. Doesn't realise that, and there isn't a government majority, and even within the government benches, be it Labour bench, when Labour was a majority or not, Lords there think they've got a role to play that's not just to be there as party voting fodder. And if they see the legitimate role of the House of Lords as it currently exists being one to revise and reform, then they will not take readily to whips saying, well, you can't revise and reform. And therefore, the Lords have got, ministers and Lords have got to be able to be given some leeway. Now, that made it difficult in some bills. I mean, the Parliamentary Voting Systems Bill was difficult to give leeway because it was actually a very tightly bound coalition agreement. We were able to do some things on public hearings, but it made it more difficult to get the legislation through. But as I say, I think that's actually a thing generally about the relationship between Commons and Lords, one which perhaps coalition has highlighted but has always been there. And as well, the relationship between the two parties in coalition and the Lords, I think for the most part, Philip's right, it's good. And perhaps the thing that bonded us most was when we had to go through the night, very late into the night, for the 19 days that we had in committee on the PVSC bill. It was quite a bonding experience.
I want to elaborate on that comment. So, Nick, are you a Thatcherite, a Christian Democrat, or do you represent the Third Way?
I think I probably should start by saying, as a new boy MP, I think the definition of an injudicious comment is when two very senior and experienced opponents immediately seize on it and turn it against you. So I will have to be more careful in future. I think, though, actually, that Malcolm sort of answered himself, because he started by asking, why does David Cameron change course? And then said, is the Conservative Party still a party that is trying to appeal to the moderate centre ground? And the answer to the second question is yes, and that's why on a couple of occasions he's changed course. I actually think it's a good balance, that he's basically very ambitious and very radical, but also pretty ruthless. And I don't say that as a criticism. I think it's a good thing in a prime minister. So, you know, he gives his ministers their head. He allows them to come up with bold plans. He doesn't buy the argument that you can only do one thing at a time. But actually, if they haven't managed to persuade people, if they haven't assembled a coalition beyond politics to support what are difficult proposals, if basically people don't like them and are saying so in very, very loud and clear terms, unless it's absolute the heart of the strategy of the government, into which only, you know, two or three things fall, education reform, solving the budget deficit and welfare reform probably would be the three big things. Unless it's those, then, you know, don't let the speed and the balance and the momentum of the government be upset by some things that were extraneous. We were willing to try them, but frankly, if you haven't done your job properly, then we're going to have to dump them overboard. So I think that's probably quite a healthy thing. I think I understand Nick's concern. I used to run the implementation team for David Cameron, which was an attempt in opposition to try and make sure that our policy proposals in opposition had actually thought through some implementation steps. So I'm with you on the need to actually really think through the implementability of your proposals. There is, of course, a tension between the need to use your political capital while you still have it and while you're not sort of sunk in the quagmire to get things through, and the need to really think through how they're going to work. And, you know, if the police commissioner's bill has had a reverse at the very last moment, you know, we've been in government already a year and it started pretty early. So there is that tension, but I do accept that sometimes speed in Parliament can be paid for later.
Thanks. Peter?
Yeah, just 2 points. On Malcolm's point of the speed, that would have happened, I think, regardless of coalition, actually, because you know, people like Oliver Letwin are arguing that they believe two things, one of which is right, one of which is wrong. One, that Tony Blair moved too cautiously. And there was a sense, I mean, Andrew knows this much better than anyone else in this room, is that he almost didn't believe his own election victories. That they were, and therefore after the first victory, it was how can I win the second one without taking risk? And I think there's a risk aversion, understandable perhaps because of the disasters Labour had in the 80s in the earlier elections, but it related to a caution, and policy on public services only emerged really towards the 2001 election, and then of course there was Iraq. There was a reaction against that. There was also a reaction against, and I think this is where the mistake was, the current generation of Tories, I think, misread what happened to Margaret Thatcher. They think that nothing much happened until privatisation in the second term, and then in the third term the Gerbil, the greater education, well, like the Gerbil was just at the end of the second term, but then health reform and so on and so forth, and then privatisation of the more awkward utilities towards the end. But in fact, if you look at economic problems in 79, an awful lot happened in the first Tory term. And the other thing was that she did have a tactical difference. It was one big battle at a time. There wasn't any lack of radicalism in the first term. It was deciding where your battles were and proceeding from one to the other, and then on the whole winning them. And I think the question mark about now is the broad front strategy. To go back to the military metaphor, and unfortunately there aren't any other military historians in the room to take up Nick's point, but is that Thatcher believed in one battle and then moving on to the next battle. I think the question mark is, can you do an all-round one? Just on Philip's point briefly, where he gave the very good explanation of what's happening in the Lords. And in a sense, the challenge to the post-99 convention, that no one single party would have a majority, which is the guts of it, and as Philip's pointing out, the 16 defeats and the variability. I think in relation between the two houses, we've yet to see that fully tested, apart from the AV bill, which is a pretty unusual one because of the time limit in order to have the referendum last week. On other bills, we've yet really to see what's going to happen on time, when there's more time. And a lot of the defeats, say, on public bodies bill, haven't really gone back to be fully considered in the Commons. I think what it does mean is that it's very interesting to hear the comments after the Police Commissioners Bill. It was in the coalition agreement. Police commissioners were also in the Tory manifesto. Now, but not obviously in the Lib Dem manifesto. And I think that raises quite an interesting thing, what you refer to. I, in practice, believe that the narrow definition of Salisbury Addison, it was in the party's manifesto, is dead. It's got to be, in a sense, government second readings of bills got to apply. And then there's an argument about the detail. But it's very difficult to point to anything, and the doctrine of the mandate is pretty thin anyway. So I think we're talking about government bills which had a second reading in the Commons. But it does need, particularly, if, and it's a very long-term if, which we haven't discussed, on Lords reform goes through, these conventions need to be rethought.
Thank you very much. Will?
I'll just stick to Malcolm's question about U-turns, because I think there's another explanation. I think they're misunderstanding the lessons from Tony Blair and going too quickly. I've been astonished by the number of cabinet members who've said how much they rely on Tony Blair's book as their guidance for what to do in government. And of course, Blair did say that he regretted having been slow in the first term. Actually, that slightly surprised me, because when you look at the achievements of Labour's first term, National Minimum Wage, Human Rights Act, Freedom of Information, Race Relations and so on, these were things that I think if you asked certainly Labour Party members, and I suspect many members of the public, what they think their favourite policies of Labour's were, probably two-thirds might be in the first term. So I think Blair actually achieved a lot. Perhaps what he was saying is, given the circumstances of his landslide, he could have been more radical with some of the things that he wanted to do later on, like NHS and education reform. So I think that they've been very hasty in pushing through some of these policies in very different circumstances, i.e. a coalition. And that's meant that there have been three types of things that have tripped them up. What hasn't tripped them up have been the real policies that they thought through, which Nick was describing. Things like free schools, they put a lot of time and energy into doing it, and we can see that the policies, whether you agree or disagree with them, they're being implemented pretty well. But one group was compromises. So things like the referendum on AV was very much a compromise, dreamt up over those 5 days, and I think has ended up doing things like answering a question the public weren't interested in. Then you've got completely new policies, things like the NHS reforms, which weren't in the coalition agreement, and which they might have done some thinking about in advance, but because they hadn't warmed up the public, you've now got a big backlash from both the public and from the sort of producer interests. And third, the impact of spending cuts. I've heard people describe the Conservative approach or the coalition approach as ready, fire, aim. I think that's quite apt, because if you do spending cuts at that level and do it from a, we're going to cut 30% from DEFRA and we're going to cut this percent from that department, and then you go back and say, okay, what are we going to cut? Then you end up having to do things like forestries, where there's suddenly a big backlash you weren't expecting. I imagine there'll be a big backlash against cuts to Coast Guards in the next year or two. Building schools for the future was the same, as was school sports. So all these things are a result of them setting a framework for their spending cuts and not thinking through how they would actually implement them.
I saw one question at the back, next door, and then, yes please, in the front.
Ian Corby from the Parliamentary Resources Unit. My question is about whether the coalition has wrong-footed the opposition. It's quite trendy to talk about how the Liberals are struggling at the moment, but Labour really didn't do very well last week. Have they worked out how to tackle coalition government effectively?
Anyone for Will?
Ryan Walker, Constitution Unit. Looking ahead to Second Wind and what the first year tells us about us, three issues which are interlinked. How much privatisation will the Lib Dems wear in public service reform? And welfare policy, there's a lot of overlap between all three parties, but how can you have welfare at work when there's no work and there's no social housing being built? And thirdly, crime and punishment, where there's a clash between, as has been mentioned before, Home Office and Justice, which I believe is a huge issue. Now, how do we write strategies for all three that are interlinking and make sense? And are there any other additions that you'd like to mention?
I'm Robert Morland. I'm a former Conservative MEP. Therefore, I'm firing my guns in the leftward direction. And it's similar to the question before last. Going back, Andrew, to your original point about the poll at the beginning, which showed the lack of popularity of coalition, I would suspect beg the question, if the Lib Dems had refused to go into any coalition, we'd be seeing polls which would be saying, you know, we really should have coalitions, and we might even see a lot of polls showing the Liberals losing a lot of support because they hadn't gone into a coalition, they hadn't been prepared to stand up. And in that context, and the question prior to the last one, I would have thought the Labour Party ought to be very worried about its performance last week, because on the central issue, which is the economy and the budget deficit, I think the public may not like cuts and the cuts they're getting, like their libraries being closed, but I do think they have some sense that it's necessary. And I think Labour playing around saying, well, we shouldn't go quite this far, is not actually working.
Thank you very much. Will, two of those questions are for you. Has Labour been wrong-footed, and are you very, very worried?
Okay, on the local elections and the Scottish and Welsh elections, I think it's very important not to be complacent about those results, and Scotland certainly was a wake-up call for the Labour Party, absolutely no doubt about that. In Wales, it was one seat away from winning an overall majority, and looks like it's going to govern as a minority. In England, I think the picture was rather better in some respects than people have set out in the newspapers, for a couple of reasons. The first is that Labour won 850 councils. That was the second best result since 1981 for the Labour Party. And I mean, that's a long period, and it was in government for some of that. But it was only actually in 1995 that it has done any better in any election cycle. Yes, it was coming from a low base. But if you look at what the expectations were, people like Luke Akehurst, who sits on the Labour Party's NEC, were suggesting that 400 to 600 would have been historically good good result. And even Labour supporting but critical people like Dan Hodges were suggesting that 700 to 800 would be a good result. So to end up at 850 may not have been the 1,000 that Baroness Varsi was saying would be a good result for the Labour Party, but it was actually where Labour strategists were suggesting was a decent result. Where did those results take place? Not in the South, and that is a big problem that Labour needs to address. But it did in the Northwest and in the Midlands get back control of councils and councillors that it had lost last time round, reinforcing its position in some of the most marginal seats, either that it lost in 2010 or that it needs to hold, to win back. And it's coming from a very low base. The other thing was that where the Labour Party targeted its resources, for example, in Gravesham rather than Dartford and Darwin in the northwest, Gedling, there were very, very good results. In the northwest, there was one swing of 21% against the Tories in one ward where some real energy was put in. So I think it was a mixed picture, but it wasn't the disaster that many people have talked about. And if we're right about it being, you know, 4 or 5 years, or 3 or 4 years to the next election, there's time to build up those activists on the ground. And the point about where do you go next, and I think it's very reasonable to ask, well, what's Labour's majority strategy? How does Labour win a majority at the next election unless it makes some gains in the South? But I asked the same question to David Cameron and the Conservatives. They can't win any more seats off Labour in the South. There aren't any. So where do you go? You've got to look in the Scotland where they made no gains at all. I think they beat their record of making this the worst ever result in Scotland that they've had. In the Northwest and Midlands, as I say, Labour shored up its position. They might try and take some seats off the Lib Dems, but I don't see a very clear pathway for a stable majority government for David Cameron, unless there's something very dramatic that happens to the fortunes of the Tories and Labour, respectively. On the economy and the budget deficit, I think there's no doubt that the opinion polls saying who do you trust more on the economy, that Osborne and the coalition are favoured to Ed Balls and Ed Miliband. But I think the tide is turning on what the public think about the cuts. There was a populist poll for the Times this week. Some of you will have seen the headlines mainly about Clegg and the coalition. Right in the weeds of that, it showed that 55% think that the cuts are not good for the economy and not necessary. So I think there's a change there, and as the cuts start to kick in, I think that people's opinion will change even more on that. And if the economy continues to be sluggish, put aside double dips, I don't think we'll have a double dip, but if the economy continues to be sluggish and an argument can be made about growth and particularly about jobs, then I think that the tide may turn. None of this is to be complacent, but I don't think the picture is as bad as some people make it out to be.
Yeah, just briefly, on the opposition point, is that the oppositions take time to recover. That actually Labour hasn't had the internal problems it had after 79. I mean, that's a big plus for it. There's been actually a very big turnover in people at the top of the Labour Party with retirement and people stepping down and so on. So Labour has rebuilt itself, but it takes a long time to convince the public that it's ready for government again. I mean, it will take a number of years to do that. I mean, in a sense, the strategy Will described earlier of assuming the coalition of four or five years is probably necessary for Labour to banish some of the memories of 2007 to 2010. You need to get that, push that behind you. For that to be forgotten, it's not entirely forgiven. And in the rebuilding process, does take time. There's also a slight nightmare for Labour, which is what happened in February 74. The only chance of Labour coming, either forming a majority on its own or being clearly the largest single party in forming a minority government, is if the economy doesn't work out, if there's economic crisis. Now, I think one of the big challenges for Labour then, will it have a coherent economic strategy? Labour did not have a coherent economic strategy in February 74. We had an appalling period of government, admittedly an enormous mess left by the Heath government, but there was an appalling period really until 76 when things got sorted out, the party's over and all that stuff. And I think that the danger is the only circumstances which in the short term when Labour could clearly win power might be when it doesn't want to win power because the economy is an awful mess. So I think there's a paradox there. The real thing is it takes a long time for opposition to recover. Just look at Labour in the 80s. Look at the Tories. It took them three defeats before they even began, and they didn't really fully succeed last year in winning back public confidence. It can't be done quickly.
Thanks. Nick, what advice have you got for Ed Miliband?
I think everything that the Labour Party is doing is marvellous, and I wouldn't want them to change a thing.
Jim.
I think Peter put his finger on it, just how crucial the economy and a government's economic performance is, because I think he's right that Labour took a long, long time to recover after the late 70s. And the events of Black Wednesday in 1992 dogged the Conservative Party not only during the remainder of that period of government, which actually was most of that period of government, but also years into opposition. The point, of course, is Liberal Democrats. We've never, I mean, you know, so far remote that we never had any responsibility for economic policy. No one actually did trust us on the economy because they didn't actually know how we would perform in the economy. And that's why I think we have got a clear vested interest in making sure that this works. And, I mean, quite apart from the fact that, you know, wanting it to work for the benefit of the country as a whole, I think there's clearly a party interest in being seen to be associated and part of a government which actually came in to office when things were a pretty low level in terms of the economy, and is there and is playing its part in trying to turn it around. We will be judged, I have no doubt, as will the Conservative Party in 2015, as to how well we perform on that. So I think the economy is going to be the crucial test. It's why we formed a coalition in the first place, and I think above all else is how we'll be judged when the next general election takes place.
Just should we come in, because the gentleman from the Constitution Unit, we've not addressed his question at all. I was just going to say that there are areas of disagreement, of course, fundamental disagreement, but one of the things, I mean, one of the things about being a Conservative is that you accept that you don't need to change everything, that some things can just be left, broadly speaking, as they are. Now, we might want to make some radical changes to our relationship with the European Union. You might want to make radical changes in the opposite direction, or Liberal Democrats, sorry, might want to make radical changes in the opposite direction. There is, of course, an alternative, which is therefore not to make any radical changes. And the same will apply to other areas of fundamental disagreement. It may frustrate us on both sides. You know, we're all very frustrated about the European Court of Human Rights telling us what our policy should be for prisoner voting. But the fact is, we're probably not going to make a radical change to that relationship because there isn't consensus. It isn't a problem. Lots of governments don't make radical changes to some areas.
I see two contributors on the web page. Jonathan Porter, who was Frank Beckmeyer, and Robert Hazel. Perhaps they might like to raise questions first.
Thanks, Andrew. I'll resist the Jonathan Portis from the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. I'll resist the temptation to comment on fiscal policy, since I do that quite a lot in other contexts, and try and step back from, we've had a lot of political questions, and back to more sort of processy government questions. And I think there's an interesting tension which comes out reading Akash's chapter, mine and Julian's chapter, and also some of the stuff that Jill has done, not just in this, but in the policy making stuff, which is that there is a clear consensus among, you know, that's reflected in the Institute's publications and among senior civil servants and former senior civil servants like me, that the process of coalition government has really worked remarkably well. The process works, civil servants are happier, things, you know, get done in a proper way with things, options on paper being decided and so on. That is a contrast to some of what we've seen under the previous government, and a welcome one. On the other hand, I think there's also a consensus, and it's reflecting something, that actually, in terms of actual substance, the way policy making has, if anything, probably got rather worse. There is a rather deliberate aversion to evidence-based policy making in at least some parts of the government. There are decisions which were clearly taken there are a number of decisions which were clearly taken even though the evidence suggested that they were silly, there's also, as Jill and I have discussed, something of a prejudice against piloting or being experimental, which partly relates to Nick's point about the blitzkrieg approach. And, you know, there are policies which are potentially quite sensible and good, which I think, you know, like the work program, where the decision has been taken unnecessarily, and perhaps just to go ahead and do them all at once without trying to test them out. And I wondered whether anyone had any views on whether this was to some extent of a result of the coalition process. The coalition process, because the process works better, means that in process terms, you get these agreements and it's all nailed down, but there's less of a chance to actually get some of the substance right.
Thanks very much. Robert?
Robert Hazel, from the Constitution, a fellow of the IFG. I think I'd like to make two comments about the democracy within each of the governing parties and link that to the prospects for a midterm review of the coalition agreement. We're doing a special research project on the coalition government and how it works. Can everyone hear? In the first year. And we've been struck interviewing parliamentarians in both houses at the quite rapid developments that have taken place within the Lib Dems in the formation of what are now called party parliamentary committees. And there are 12 or 15 of these, roughly one for each Whitehall department and policy area. And they have a co-chair or convener from each House of Parliament. They meet very regularly, typically weekly. They often have meetings with the relevant minister, sometimes a Tory minister, not always a Lib Dem. And they also bring in representatives from the party, party headquarters, party policy experts and the like. And from what I can judge, that's a significant advance on the nature of internal party debate compared with previous parliaments, but I stand to be corrected by Jim. I know these aren't wholly new as bits of machinery, but I sense that they've become much more effective. And the interviews that we've been doing with Conservatives suggest an element of envy and now possible emulation within the Conservative Party with a revival of committees of the 1922 committee. And again, I sense, although the tradition in the Tory party has been a less participatory one in terms of thrashing out policy, they watch these Lib Dem committees and I think are gradually now, as I say, beginning to catch up. The question I'm building towards is, both parties in principle, although they've never said it publicly, have in the first year, I think, privately agreed that starting in the second year, they would embark on a midterm review of the programme for government. And it's something that we have encouraged them to do, because a programme for government set in stone for a five-year term clearly makes no sense, especially if going at the pace they have of the blitzkrieg, they've achieved most of it in the first 2 years or so. But I sense possible difficulties now, and I'm beginning to wonder whether to try to modify my advice about a midterm review if it's done in a very public way. The Lib Dems, famously participatory and democratic party, have thought about a possible process. It would involve the Federal Policy Committee submitting ideas to the party conference this September, a draft to the party conference next spring, and a final version of a coalition 2.0, or whatever you call the programme for government for the second half of the parliament, at their conference next September, September 2012. And the Conservatives, if my thesis is correct, might want to set in train similar participatory machinery to hammer out your ideas for contributing to the second half. The dilemma, I think, for both parties is, it was one thing to negotiate and agree the programme for government in those five very intense days when you knew you had to work incredibly fast and there wasn't an awful lot of time for dissenters outside the room to make their voices loudly heard. If this midterm review takes place over a period of 12 to 15 months, we know there are discontents in both parties and they will have plenty of opportunities to make their voices heard. So how would you advise anyone to set about the midterm review?
Thank you.
Neil Nerva, I'm actually chair of Hampstead and Kilburn Labour Party. And I spent the election handing out leaflets and we were criticised saying, vote Clegg, get Cameron. And it actually happened. Anyway, it follows on the last point. It's about what the impact of the coalition will be, not so much now, but actually towards the end of this parliament. Assuming it lasts, and assuming Nick has four more presentations to us about what's going on, how do we expect to see the coalition, not so much dissolve, but separation in the lead up to the 2015 election? And what do we think the impact of that will be on the 2015 election in terms of parties having to declare their hand in advance and not wait for the 5 days?
Thank you. I think We've only got time for one more roundup from the panel. I did see Alan Evans wanted to catch my eye at the front.
Thank you, Alan Evans. I just wanted to ask a question about a forthcoming challenge, a slightly more complex challenge in the past, which is that of renewal of the government. If you go back to 97, by this time, Tony Blair was looking forward to his first reshuffle when he moved on four or five cabinet ministers, and we got around to something which was almost approaching the annual reshuffle. I think people recognise now that that's bad for a whole number of reasons, but there'll come a time when, for whatever reason, either because ministers have to step down or because the Prime Minister wants to bring forward talent, that he'll want to refresh his government. And it's not nearly as straightforward as it used to be, given that the patronage is not entirely in his hands. I wonder what the challenges that he'll need to go through, both himself and with Nick Clegg, to get that type of balance and to get the type of change which will be inevitable to keep the pace of the government going.
Gave that up after 2 years, and I'm glad to see the coalition.
Hold on. We have got the annual report, Andrew. On the website today, it's the coalition government. I mean, it's not as bad as the annual report, which is dreadful. This is what promises the coalition is well on the way to completing two-thirds of the total promises commitments made in the coalition agreement, some of which I think the coalition agreement means to hold conferences. But anyway, so there is a mini annual report, Andrew.
Following a bit too closely on the Blair precedent.
Matthew Spencer, Green Alliance. Two quick questions. Is there a coherent attitude to business and NGO stakeholders amongst the coalition? It's clearly not big tent, Blair-style pluralist engagement of stakeholders. What is it? And second question, how important is the Greenest Government Ever ambition to the coalition?
Thanks so much. Well, there were a number of interesting questions there. Are we facing a government process good, policy poor, and policy poor in part because the process is so smooth inside the coalition itself in terms of decision making. What do we think of the prospects for the midterm review and the renewal of the coalition agreement? How might the coalition end? And since, of course, neither Nick nor Jim will want to contemplate the possibilities of defeat, how do they think the two parties will work together in the immediate run-up to the next election, which is clearly going to be a critical issue? And Alan's question, which I take to mean, how can the government, about a year in, if it's not going to be reshuffling and producing annual reports, what can it do that will renew itself? Will.
I'll stick to the questions about the midterm review and the point about coming up to manifestos. I've spent quite a lot of time recently with members of the Social Liberal Forum. Left Foot Forward was always set up as a progressive website rather than just a Labour Party website, so we invited right from the start contributors from the Green Party and the sort of Social Liberal side of the Lib Dems. And what's really interesting when you talk to them, they feel very emboldened at the moment because of what happened at the Lib Dem Spring Conference, where Evan Harris's motion on the NHS, supported by Baroness Williams, drafted by a number of the people who sit on their policy group, essentially changed and forced Clegg's hand on the NHS policy. And I think they would argue, I mean, perhaps Clegg and members of the Lib Dem government would say it was different, but they argue it was their intervention which forced Clegg to take a different position on the NHS. They're having a conference on the 18th of June. They're very bullish about this. They see this as their chance to set out some policies and some positions that they are then going to use, because they have control of the policy-making organs, democratic organs of the Liberal Democrats, to push through a series of things that they want to see as part of the coalition, the sort of second stage of the coalition agreement. And I think their view is not one of compromise and going in and trying to split the difference. It's, we're going to have a very clear set of things that are Lib Dem policies, and we may trade off one of those to knock one of the right of the Tory parties, but that's our agenda. And I think I don't talk to, and not for any huge disdain, just I don't have the contacts with Orange Bookers, but I don't know whether they have a strategy in place that is anywhere near as sophisticated and understands the machinery of the Liberal Democrats in the way that the Social Liberal Forum seems to. In terms of the manifesto, it does seem to me that parties, particularly if the next election approaches, and as I suspect we may be heading for a second hung parliament, or at least a sort of small majority government, will need to be much more explicit about what it is that they're going to retain in coalition agreements? What are their red lines? And I don't think you'll see the Liberal Democrats or anyone else putting up posters of VAT bombshells or signing NUS pledges or talking quite so forcefully about the impact of spending cuts. I think that will be left behind and seen as a mistake from the past.
Thank you. Peter?
Yeah, I mean, just on a couple of points. I mean, on John's point, I think this would happen without the coalition, because I think the determination of the Cameron team was just to press ahead. It was the blitzkrieg. It wasn't piloting. It was to, you know, we believe in this, and we're not too concerned about the evidence, because we believe in this, and we're going to do it. So I think that applied anyway. I think on Robert's question, I'm not sure the machinery matters very much. I wonder how much is window dressing on some of this, and it's much more to do with the raw politics of it. And it actually ties in with Alan's point on renewal and refreshing. We all know under coalitions it's much more difficult to do reshuffles, because you've got to decide on the post, the personality. There's a very interesting thing on the Cabinet Office website when there was a kind of process agreement reached, that obviously David Cameron as Prime Minister appoints, but only after consulting Nick Clegg when it's a Lib Dem, and so on and so forth. So it does make it more difficult. Indeed, for some work which we're going to be publishing in 12 days' time on ministerial effectiveness, one of my colleagues has dug up some fascinating statistics from Germany on the number of reshuffles in the coalitions there of business ministers, and the number of business ministers that have been since the war in Germany, which has been mainly coalition, compared with here, and it's about a third of the number of, you know, business or trade and industry ministers. I think it makes it much more difficult to do, as well as tying in, interestingly enough, what again comes back to the point, what anyway happened, Cameron was anyway opposed to the idea of having frequent reshuffles, partly because of the previous experience, but the coalition has made it more difficult to do. I think there will have to be, and there are all kinds of, and we've got a two-year session of Parliament now, and also there's a kind of natural break next year. I think sometime around the summer of next year, looking ahead to the election, will both be personality and a degree of policy pulling it together. It'll all depend on what the raw politics looks like then. On the very interesting question, what happens at the end, we actually have two to my right, someone who's done that. What do you do at the end of a coalition? I'm looking forward to hearing Jim's answer.
Well, Jim gathers his thoughts. Nick, you punted out the idea in your book a few months ago that perhaps an electoral pact and some formal agreement might be a good idea between the two parties. You still of that opinion?
I mean, I'm certainly of the view that there will be seats around the country. I never really expected it to be universal, but that there may be individual constituencies where there will be an advantage for both Conservatives and Liberal Democrats to have some quiet arrangement. And now that doesn't necessarily have to be a sort of formal, you know, the two leaders come onto a balcony and announce the pact. It can be just that one party takes its own sweet time about selecting its candidate and then selects somebody who's not perhaps absolutely the strongest. So they can work in many different forms. But obviously it does require firstly, us to have worked very well together for several years. Secondly, the Labour Party to not have woken up to the fact that perhaps it shouldn't be quite so mean to its obvious coalition partner, the Liberal Democrats, and drive them, you know, ever further into our arms. So there are many things that would have to happen for that to be realistic. I think the breakup question is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating question. I think that it all depends on whether the big party in the coalition, because I think it's probably a general thing, though obviously here it applies to us, whether you think that you have, or and indeed the big opposition party, whether you think you actually have a cracking chance at an overall majority. Because let's imagine you get to November of 2014, and if bluntly, it doesn't look very likely that anyone's going to get a substantial overall majority, then the likelihood is that you're hoping to be in government, in our case remain, in Labour's case come in coalition with Liberal Democrats, and therefore you're going to want to be quite tactful and tactical about how you run your campaign. You'll have your own ideas, you'll push them very, very hard, you'll say they're much better than the Liberal Democrat and the Labour ideas, but you probably won't trash in quite such an obvious way the policies and the people and the record of the party you might want to be in coalition with. On the other hand, and somebody made the point, you know, it's easier to see immediately based on last week's results how Conservative Party picks up some seats in the South West than it is necessarily how we pick them up in Scotland. If that's the case and we think, actually, you know, we're on 44% of the polls or something, we actually really could get a majority of 50. Does that change the calculation of the campaigners? I think it's much too early to tell. And I hope that what will happen is that we'll have a, you know, reasonably polite campaign where the differences will focus on our proposals rather less than on our pasts. But, you know, we probably hope that we'd have a polite AV referendum campaign, and look what happened to that.
I think Nick has just given the lie to his own expectation and hope. Jim?
I mean, first of all, pick up on one of the points that Robert Hazell was making about the party parliamentary committees, which we have and which shadow departments and has a co-chair from Lords and Commons, which I think does work well. It does mean that there's a relationship. It varies from department to department, but for example, in DCMS, where there's no Liberal Democrat minister, the co-chairs are actually very well treated by the ministers there. They actually attend ministerial meetings, so there's actually some Liberal Democrat input there, and it's very useful for ministers to be able to have a point of contact. And I think it would be useful, I think, for some Liberal Democrat ministers of the Conservative Party did develop a similar structure, because, you know, having these points of contact, particularly when legislation is going through, there's some controversial policy, or even non-controversial policy, where you just want to get some soundings, it's useful to have that. With regard to midterm review, I certainly was on record in Scotland before the coalition government here that I thought midterm review was probably right. We hadn't done it. But, you know, there's no reason why when you get halfway through you should be sticking to implement policies which were maybe right 2.5 years ago when the manifestos were drawn up, but for time reasons, rather than not necessarily the policies were wrong, but they no longer have the relevance or the salience that they once had, and to refresh is probably the right thing. How that is done, I think, still remains to be seen. But, you know, if Liberal Democrats through conferences set out a stall, I wouldn't expect the compromise to take place in the Liberal Democrat conference. If you're going into negotiation, you don't make all your compromises before you go into the negotiation. But I think that is still uncharted waters. And finally, with regard to the breakup of the dissolution of the coalition, I was regularly asked in Scotland, well, you'll pull out of this coalition 3 months before the election, won't you? And I thought I could think of nothing that the electorate would treat more cynically. I said, you've been in government for 3.5 years, and suddenly, just, you know, you want to be in opposition in the run-up to an election. And it never actually ever crossed my mind that we would do that, because I thought the punishment for doing that would be so great. And another thing, as I hope we continue an effective government in the run-up to 2015, that we will get to the dissolution of the Parliament and we will go our separate ways and fight an election. And in the run-up to that, I mean, we as a party in Scotland produced a pre-election manifesto about 9 months out, which set out policies that were not part of the coalition agreement, but were clearly then what we would be fighting the election on. And I was able to present that as a party leader rather than as a minister of the coalition. And that was, as I think I said in my opening remarks, it's about being grown up and being mature. But in a culture where that's not, where that nature of coalition politics isn't necessarily always understood, that sometimes can be difficult. And when it comes to the election, I don't believe that there will be any electoral pacts. I think the parties will fight on their own terms and their own putting forward their own policies. In the 2003 Scottish election, actually, we gained a seat from the Labour Party, actually defeating a Scottish Labour cabinet minister in doing so, who used to be my deputy, and it was a very awkward moment I had when I next met him. And he was pretty cut up about it, but he said, "Oh, fair. We were fighting each other, and your party won." And bastards. But no, seriously, I think we will fight that. We will fight an election. But I think I do take Nick's point. What I never could do in an election in 2003, after 4 years in government, when I fought and Jack McConnell was first minister, it would have been to have launched personal attacks or to have, you know, over-dramatised things. When you actually have been working with people, you can have very distinctive positions and you argue them from the point of view of policy and where you actually differ. And I think if that does mean that the next election is fought far more on, and perhaps the AV referendum isn't the best guide to this, but if it is fought in a mature way, I think that's probably better for politics all round, let alone which parties are engaged.
Thank you very much. Well, can we thank our panel very warmly indeed for those great contributions. And just to do a brief party political broadcast, as Peter said, in 12 days' time we're launching our next big report, which is on ministerial effectiveness. Once that's published, and Michael Heseltine is going to come
here to help us launch it. We're then starting a new study called Opposition Effectiveness, and we'll be engaging many of you in this room on those two big reports. We look forward to seeing you at one or both of those events over the coming months. Thank you very much.